Drive Time on RTÉ Radio 1, sponsored by Zurich. When investment performance matters, make sure your savings are with Zurich. Visit Zurich.ie to find out more.
Orla, thank you very much for that. A British surgeon just back from a two-week stint at the Al-Aqsa Hospital in central Gaza says the situation at the facility has been beyond any doubt the worst thing he's seen in his career. As a clinical lead in the hospital, he detailed multiple traumatic amputations of children and horrific burns, the likes of which he's never seen before. Consultant surgeon Professor Nick Maynard is now back home in Oxford and he joins us now on the line. And Professor Maynard, you're very welcome to the programme this evening. As I say, you were in Gaza for 2 weeks. You returned home last weekend. Can you talk us through your arrival? I know you entered through the Rafah gate as part of a WHO organisation humanitarian convoy, and then you had to take the journey from there to central Gaza to get to Al-Aqsa Hospital. I imagine that in itself was a perilous journey.
Yes, thank you very much for asking me on. So I've been to Gaza many times over the last 15 years, but have always entered through the Erez crossing from Israel. So this was the first time I'd gone through the Rafah crossing. And to get from Rafah to middle Gaza, we had to go through the town of Rafah and then up the coastal road. And we were in an area that was officially deconflicted by the Israeli Defense Force, but there had been bombings there the day before. And I guess it's important to note that when an area is deconflicted and what the Israeli Defense Corps calls the green zones, they are only deconflicted in terms of ground forces. They're not deconflicted in terms of aerial bombardment. So even if it's designated a safe area, there is always a significant threat of aerial bombardment. So we were very aware of this. So it was a difficult journey and it was very slow because we witnessed many hundreds of people in vehicles migrating south, having been evacuated from mid-Gaza. So we saw hundreds of cars, some of them with up to 15 people in them. And I saw one car with four people sitting in the front passenger seat, doors open because they couldn't close the doors, all their belongings on the roof of the car. And this was a mass evacuation of the population into Rafah. So that was a sight I would never have dreamt of seeing.
You got to Al-Aqsa then, the main general hospital in the centre of Gaza. Can you talk us through what you saw there?
Yeah, so Al-Aqsa is a small hospital in Gaza. I haven't worked there previously. I've worked in Shifa Hospital and other hospitals, but I've never been to Al-Aqsa Hospital. But it's a small hospital. It has a normal capacity of about 150 patients. And the capacity when I was there for the 2 weeks was over 700 at the time. So when we approached the hospital, the crowding was like nothing I've ever seen before. Many people have migrated to the hospitals in Gaza because they are considered to be safe areas. So they use the hospitals as shelters. So in the roads surrounding the hospital, there were many thousands of people who had moved there. They'd set up very makeshift tents using tarpaulin, using cloth, using plastic sheets. They had made homemade clay ovens to cook on. There was no sanitation. There was no running water, no electricity. And it was like a town had been built rapidly in the immediate surroundings of the hospital. So it took our vehicle, you know, probably the best part of an hour to get through all of that. And then into the hospital, again, the crowds were overwhelming. There were not only over 700 patients, which was more than four times the normal capacity. There were also many thousands of people and relatives inside the hospital or inside the ground. So inside the hospital, you could hardly move because of all the patients in the reception areas, on the stairwells, in the wards, in the recovery rooms, in the radiology department, just covered in patients and relatives lying on the floor. A few beds, but mainly people lying on the floor. So scenes I've never seen before.
And of course, given what is going on in Gaza at the moment, the need for medical treatment has never been greater. You were there to conduct surgeries. Can you tell us about what injuries you were treating and who were the types of patients you were seeing in terms of men and women and children?
Yeah, so I was trained as a general surgeon. My main specialty is cancer surgery of the upper gastrointestinal tract, but I was effectively doing a lot of abdominal and thoracic trauma surgery when I was there. And there was another colleague of mine from London who was similar skill set. So we were doing a lot of abdominal operations for blast injuries from bomb injuries, essentially with shrapnel having gone into the abdomen and thoracotomies for chest injuries. And the shrapnel, which goes through the chest wall or the abdominal wall and just shreds the internal organs. So these were patients who were bleeding massively with in the chest, their lungs having been torn to pieces by the shrapnel, in the abdomen, all the intestinal, all the abdominal organs, the liver, the spleen, the intestines, the duodenum, all often shredded by the shrapnel. So this was, they were very sick and they required very major surgery to sort out all the damage.
And in terms of conducting that surgery, what facilities did you have available to you?
So we had a treatment room adapted into an operating theatre, and we had a fairly basic set of operation tools which were adequate, but we had to make do with a very limited supply of suture materials and needles. There were none of the luxuries that we're used to in England and Ireland of using devices for stapling guns to join bowel together again. We had to make do with a very basic set of surgical instruments. On one day we had no running water in the operating theatre, so we couldn't scrub up. So we had to use alcohol gel to clean our hands. On another day, they'd run out of sterile drapes for the patients in theatres. So we had to sort of make our own sterile drapes out of surgical gowns. So the Gazans are an incredibly resourceful people, and we had to adapt along the lines they have been doing for some time in order to do these surgeries.
What about pain relief?
So pain relief was often lacking. There are some days when there was no morphine, no strong painkillers. You asked earlier what were the patients we were seeing. Well, a lot of them were children. I was operating on adults, some men, a lot of young women. In fact, the majority of the patients I operated on were young women. But in the emergency department, we saw a huge number of children as well, some as little as a few months old, with the most terrible burns. And you know, the burns I would never have wanted to have seen in my life, and the images which will be with me forevermore. A lot of traumatic amputations, I didn't operate on those. They were operated on by the orthopedic surgeons, but I saw a lot of these people coming in with legs having been blown off or arms having been blown off, often very small children. And as I said, the most shocking and appalling wounds, burns down to the bone. And sometimes there was no pain relief for these children. There was no morphine to give these children who had lost their legs or had these terrible burns. It was an apocalyptic picture. It really was.
In terms of the aftercare then, or indeed the care that they're getting, despite everyone, as you say, doing their absolute best and being as resourceful as possible, because of the unsanitary conditions that you're talking about, is there a huge concern about infection and follow-up care for these really traumatic injuries?
Yeah, it's a great question, and you're absolutely right. There was a huge amount of infections. I'd say the majority, well over 50% of the wounds, were getting terrible infections. The everywhere was dirty, and this was no reflection on the individuals. There were very, very few staff there. So, and everyone was living so closely together that it was inevitable these infections were going to happen. So, yes, we saw some terrible, terrible infections, some of which would have led to patients dying. Many of them with the terrible infections, we had to reoperate on the wounds to deal with the infection. So it was a absolutely massive problem. And of course, when these patients get these bad infections, they're already very poorly nourished. And then they have this big bomb injury, which again uses up their metabolic rate, goes up hugely. They consume a lot of energy. Then they get the infection. So this then converts a sort of a marginal nutritional state into severe malnutrition. And of course, their immune system gets depressed then. So it's a vicious cycle they get into, and they spiral and get sicker and sicker. It's a devastating way for them to deteriorate.
So I suppose then, from what you're saying, you know, we have the number of casualties, the number of people who've been killed, and I know that's disputed on both sides, but we roughly have a number now that's hovering in and above the I think mid-20s at this point, maybe a little under the mid-20s. But all these, that doesn't count then, all these people that you're talking about who have these really, really severe injuries, and 50% of those having very severe infections. Like, would you expect the number of deaths, I suppose, to result from that to be very high as well?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think that the people who've got infections related to their surgery will increase that number. But what we're also seeing is what we're all familiar with the term excess deaths from the COVID pandemic. Mm-hmm. And I think the excess deaths, which will happen over the next few months, will dwarf the death rate we've seen so far. And by that I mean other infections, sort of communicable diseases, perhaps not related to wounds. So infectious diseases due to having dirty water. There's gastroenteritis is running rife through the children population in the shelters. The conditions couldn't be more perfect in a way for a cholera outbreak. It hasn't happened yet, but we're very fearful that might happen. And if cholera breaks out in one of these shelters, that would be devastating. None of the non-communicable diseases are being treated properly. So diabetes, heart disease, kidney disease, all these other diseases, which normally would be treated, are not being treated adequately, either because there aren't any drugs or the dialysis, so no insulin, or there's no dialysis machines for treating kidney failure, or there's no way of treating the heart disease. And these will massively increase the number of deaths, I fear.
Just finally, given what you're describing there, you know, we are seeing very shocking images on our television screens and on social media coming out of Gaza. I wonder, though, do you think people understand still what's going on, despite what we're seeing?
Golly, that's a good question. I fear people don't, and that's not in any way a reflection on people's understanding of it or whatever. I don't think the media generally has portrayed it as in as much accuracy as needed. I know Gaza really well. I've been going there for 14 years. I know the hospitals well. Since October the 7th, I was talking almost daily to colleagues and friends of mine on the ground in Gaza and Shifa Hospital. So I thought I knew exactly what was going on, and I thought that I was fully prepared for what was going on when I got there, and I wasn't. It was much worse than I expected, and it was extremely distressing seeing so much of this. So however accurately it may or may not be being reported, it will always underestimate the true horrors of what's going on there.
Professor Nick Maynard, thank you very much for joining us.